I'm going to talk a little bit about near-infrared and mid-infrared spectrum of supernovae. This was sort of a topic as we looked over the program. There was sort of a hole in there. Ken talked about this a bit this morning. We didn't know that Peter was going to drop out, so Ken kind of filled in. So they're a little bit complementary, what I'm going to say and what Ken said this morning. So I'll show you some spectra. The subtopic here is kind of looking particularly for the carbon abundance to try to put a constraint on deflagration versus detonation models. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about here is from the dissertation of Howie Marion that Peter Hoflick and I co-supervised. My colleague Rob Robinson at Texas, Chris Girardi, who was at Texas, moved to Imperial College. Bill Vaca has been our near-infrared collaborator in a lot of this. We have been working with Ken and Motohara and the Subaru team on some of it. I'm going to touch on that because Ken did a nice job this morning. And just show you one slide of the first mid-infrared spectrum we've gotten from this consortium that Peter Meikle has been leading so well. But just to remind you what a spherical delayed detonation model is, one of Peter Hoflick's models, you have iron peak stuff on the inside, and under some conditions you can get electron capture and make some of these stable nickel elements. There's a region where you've got explosive oxygen burning making the silicon sort of elements. In this particular model, there's oxygen on the outside. There is a little carbon in this particular one, but you only start getting a significant amount of carbon, which was half and half in this model to start with, out here at above 20,000 kilometers a second. So there's very little carbon in that class of models for a normally bright type 1A, and that is part of the point that we want to try to check here. Going back 10 years ago when I was last at an extended time in Santa Barbara, we were writing this paper at the time. Jason Sparamiglio came through Austin with some infrared spectra, and I ended up being the principal author in the paper, but Robert Harkness had some spectra in here, Peter Hoflick did. But just to remind you that one of Peter's models of a delayed detonation model makes predictions for what the infrared spectra is going to look like. Here it is a few days after maximum light, about a week after maximum light. Here's a couple of weeks after maximum light. Those are all intermediate mass element lines, and I'll show you those in a bit more detail. Predict these two features at sort of 1.6, 1.8 microns, or iron peak elements, primarily nickel and cobalt. And that little set of four nubbies down there are again, iron peak with some intermixture of intermediate mass elements, primarily silicon. And those, in fact, all that stuff shows up very nicely in the spectrum. But this is essentially a prediction that was made 10 years ago. So what we want to do is to search for this unburned material, and I want to dedicate this part of my talk to Wolfgang, because I thought Wolfgang did a very graceful, and I mean this seriously, a graceful concession that if one really looks at this stuff, you probably do need to have detonated stuff on the outside. But he supported those deflagration models, forced us into thinking, how do you make this argument more rigorously? So what I'm going to say in the next few slides is because Wolfgang has been out there pushing us, and this is part of our response to that. So we were looking for, can you put constraints on the unburned material, and how far out can you push that? So we looked in the near-infrared. That was one of the motivations for doing this. There are several oxygen and carbon one lines out there in the infrared that stand up more than the same kind of things in the optical. They're kind of unblended. This was Howie Marion's idea to do this snapshot program with this new SPECS near-infrared spectrometer at the IRTF. That he recognized that it was a powerful enough instrument that we could get supernovae down to like 18th magnitude. If you asked for time, you wouldn't know, you know, what supernova would be there, but it turned out that he gambled and won that there would be observable supernovae whenever you got on the IRTF. And sometimes it'd be before maximum, sometimes afterward, you would just take a snapshot. So we didn't get a time series very often, but we got a lot of data in the process. So I'm going to show you sampling of spectra that we got, 36 of them were before the maximum. And sometimes in a GRISM mode, low resolution spectroscopy, we could get down to, in this case, the shorter wavelengths to get the oxygen 7774 line. So just to show you some of the assemblages that we've got, this is, I don't know whether you can read this terribly well, this is sort of the out to about 1.4 microns, then an expansion from 0.8 microns out to 2.4, the whole spectrum here, and this is sort of near or pre-maximum, minus 13 days down to about maximum. So we get, again, this snapshot sample. These are different supernovae primarily, but they follow more or less a uniform progression that type 1As, normal type 1As in the infrared also follow a recognizable spectral progression. Here, showing up, this bump is the start of that sort of four-knuckle thingy that comes in. And I'll show you that. It's coming in more strongly. But there are a couple of oxygen lines, some magnesium lines that we can look for to try to figure out what's going on. So that's a sample of lines here, post-maximum from the day to 18 days after maximum light. Again, we can identify some silicon and sulfur and magnesium in here, the calcium infrared triplet down there. And here now comes in this iron group thing. So it turns out that double thing at 1.6 and 1.8 didn't show up as unblended as we predicted in the model. So kind of think about that. But here's this bump thing that Peter predicted would be there. And it just shows up just the way the delayed detonation models would predict. And then we're calling the transition phase from sort of 40 to 80 days after maximum light, because you're getting towards the nebular spectrum, and the spectra continue to evolve. Again, this is out to about 1.2 microns, and this is the full sweep from 0.8 out to 2.4. And again, this is this series of iron peak mixed in with silicon out there shows up quite nicely. So the results, again, looking at different supernovae and making this assemblage, is we see distinct minimum velocities. This is the oxygen one line. They see a scatter in various supernovae, but there's a floor below which we don't seem to see oxygen. Pretty much a similar floor on the magnesium. Down here, iron, we tend to trace down to lower velocities. You go, can't read that. I'll pass on it. Not the central point I wanted to make anyway. So what we did with these data was to go after the composition of the unburned material. So we're assuming that the pristine matter from the progenitor is carbon and oxygen with equal abundance. If you think that these things have grown in sort of a single degenerate model by accretion onto a shell and the shell burning to make the carbon, you predict you get roughly equal amounts of carbon and oxygen. If that's not the right assumption, that something else has happened on the outside of the white dwarf, we do need to bear that in mind. But that's the assumption going in here, taking that onsots and then checking how much of that carbon out there remains unburned in the explosion. So we did check to see whether, to what degree, if you're looking for carbon one and oxygen one, do you expect to see them in the same place? And because they don't have exactly the same ionization structure, they won't be exactly overlapped, but they are only offset by about 1,000 kilometers a second. If you assume they respond more or less with a similar ionization potential and look at the ionization structure, it turns out there will be regimes where there's oxygen but not carbon, and carbon but not oxygen, but they overlap in velocity space in this class of models predominantly. So you should expect to see oxygen and carbon in the same place over a rather extended range of velocities of order 10,000 kilometers a second for the range in velocity. So we looked at what the velocity space of the oxygen was. This actually illustrates the 7774 line and how broad it is. And we've looked at the data for some of these things. And we detect it running over velocities from 9 to about 18,000 kilometers a second. So again, the spread of velocity is 9,000 kilometers a second. If these oxygen features are due to unburned material, then there ought to be carbon sharing that same physical space in the same velocity range. And so it's looking for the carbon is what we're going to try to do here. If the oxygen is from the explosive carbon burning, then there ought to be magnesium in the same place. That is, the oxygen's burned to magnesium. Some of the oxygen is the carbon's burned to magnesium. Some of the oxygen remains unburned. Some of the oxygen can be newly formed from the carbon burning. But if there's been explosive carbon burning, we expect to see oxygen and magnesium in the same velocity space. So we've gone through and look. This is now a published paper that Howie published a year ago. Looking for the line strengths of the oxygen to carbon, the strongest carbon one line predicted in the infrared is a 1.0693 micron line, and it ought to be about 50 times stronger than the 7774 line of oxygen. So if you see the oxygen and there's carbon there that is unburned sharing the same conditions as that oxygen, it ought to come booming into this. So here's what we've done to look for this. Now this probably doesn't show up nearly as well as I'd like. Bob, you're going to laugh at me. Can you see anything there at all? Hardly. Here is the strongest carbon line. It's right here. If you track it down, it would be here. And so we see evidence for oxygen lines here, for instance. You can't see that's oxygen, that's oxygen, that's oxygen. Here's some carbon one marked up there. So we see the oxygen lines, but that's where the strongest carbon line ought to be. And there's just nothing there. There's just nothing there. So again, we find oxygen in this rather large range on the outside, It turns out, I'm not going to show you the picture for lack of time, but it turns out we can find magnesium, and the magnesium does, in fact, cover that same velocity space. So that the oxygen region comprises about the outer third of the supernova as this thing blows up. Any matter containing carbon and oxygen in nearly equal abundances, if there's any carbon there that's unburned, it's got to be greater than 18,000 kilometers a second. It's out that far, it would be dilute enough that we wouldn't be able to see it. So the upper limit that we put on the carbon in this velocity range is a few times 10 to the minus 2 solar masses is the most we can afford to put in this kind of a model. So the relative abundance of oxygen 1 and carbon 1 that we can entertain here, the oxygen has to be more abundant by the carbon by factors of 100 to 1,000 at 11,000 kilometers a second, a very easily observable place in the spectrum. And I wasn't surprised, but I was very pleased to see Tanaka in his seminar last Friday came up with a similar sort of number in recent Subaru results. But this, I don't think there's anything magic about this. Anybody with a near-infrared spectrograph can go out and do this and look for those carbon lines, and I'm pretty confident you won't find it. So that the oxygen to carbon remains well above unity all the way out to 18,000 kilometers a second, as far as we can tell. So an allusion to another thing of Robert Quimby's work. This is now in the optical, but again, I think this is something that people can do, is you get early spectra and look at the silicon lines and try to see how far out you can trace them into the blue. That Robert found evidence for silicon 2, the blue wing, out to 24,000 kilometers a second. So the silicon is there and it extends out a long way, and you have to be able to account for that. So I think in this kind of condition, again, you have to be able to burn that carbon and some of the oxygen to make the silicon out to very large velocities. So I think all these results that I've just described now for the branch core normal type 1As, the normally bright things, are consistent with delayed deflagration models, that they predict the concentric layers of burning products, lack of carbon in all regions, that the detonation burned things out, just the way Paolo was saying and Dan Kaysen said this morning. We do find the oxygen and magnesium sharing the same physical space. The carbon burning products are together. It's all quite consistent with the basic delayed deflagration model. I wasn't part of this particular piece of work, but I want to say, because I think it's so important to kind of understand this context, and I'm not showing you a picture here. Go back and look at the original paper, just trying to summarize what this one said in detail. And this is delayed deflagration models for subluminous type 1A. And this particular paper, Peter's models and Chris Girardi's observations, they looked in the near-infrared for this subluminous 1999 BY, which was a fairly close clone of 91 BG. So this model in Peter's suite of models was chosen to match the optical light curve, and the thing that matched the optical light curve had a small nickel mass. It was about a tenth of a solar mass. So you do that by tuning this density at which you make the transition from the deflagration to the detonation. So that's the free parameter in this class of models. It was chosen to be low, so you postpone the transition. So the model is expanded a lot by the time you turn on the detonation. And in that case, in this delayed detonation model, which made a tenth of a solar mass, again, it was chosen, you had to have that smaller mass to match the optical light curve, that delayed detonation model predicted there would remain some unburned carbon because you've had a lot of expansion and some of that material has gotten out to so large a radius and so low a density that even if you turn on the detonation at that point, you can't catch up with that carbon and burn it. So this particular delayed detonation model that matched the optical light curve predicts unburned carbon above about 15,000 kilometers a second. That predicts that you should see this carbon one line in that event. That's a prediction of the model, and Chris Girardi's observation saw it. So I'm not showing the picture here, but you see the carbon one line, you also see oxygen and magnesium, and the ratios of those lines in the infrared match quantitatively. Oh, it was a very powerful test of the delayed detonation model in this subluminous context, which I think is an important thing to bear in mind. So the two things that come out of that, one is we can observe the carbon one when it's present. There's nothing wrong with the observations I showed you with the carbon absent. If the carbon is there, we'll see it, and we don't in the normally bright ones. And also that the delayed deflagration models can reproduce both the optical and the near-infrared spectral evolution of both normally bright supernovae and subluminous ones. So then I want to show you just in this one slide. This is new. We've been collecting this data for a couple of years. This first paper by Girardi et al. Has just now come out. You going to tell me how much time I have? 5 minutes? I'm right on time. Thanks. So this is the first mid-infrared observation of a type 1A. And I think this is just opening up a new window. It's going to be very exciting. And we've thought through this, and we've got other data to think about. So here's some things that have come out of this particular spectra. And in the first place, it's just a wonderful piece of data with a lot of information content in it. So I think it's really going to be very neat to do. So one point is that we do see in several places, we see directly, Bob, this is partly an answer to your question, we see nickel. And this is at 135 days after the explosion. This is not nickel 56. Got to be nickel 58. It's stable nickel. So we've got a direct observation of the stable nickel. That means, as Ken talked about, and other people have, that there has to be a hole in the middle, that there's been enough electron capture to convert the nickel 56 to a stable nickel isotope in the center. So I think this is consistent with there being a nickel hole. It's consistent with that flat-topped iron spectrum that Ken showed this morning and interpreted in terms of a hole in the middle of it. There's some sense of that there may be a layering in here in the sense that that nickel line seems to be a bit narrower than the cobalt line, and the cobalt line is narrower than the argon line. Dan Kaysen pointed out to me, one's got to be a little careful because this is a weaker line and maybe you don't see all the way down to the wings. I think that is an important point. But there's a sense in which that line is the nickel line narrower than the cobalt, which suggests that the nickel's down in the slow-moving stuff, the cobalt's moving a little faster, and the argon, which is definitely broader, is moving even faster. So there might be some layering of these iron peak things down on the inside. Now, whether you believe that or not, that's sort of the point that out there, maybe that trend in the paper. But if that's true, I think this is a normally bright type 1A. So I've already made the argument for other reasons that I think it's not consistent with the pure deflagration. But that layering of the iron peak stuff on the inside is not necessarily consistent with a delayed detonation either. So we may have some new things to think about here. And then finally, just in terms of what's interesting, the argon line here, there's one here and one here, is double peaked. Definite evidence for an asymmetry. So one of the things I've learned about this, this may not make sense to anybody that people have passed through Texas, but the students at Texas have been running around doing this for the 30 years I've worked there. And I thought it had something to do with sports or football or something. But it turned out they were predicting the argon profile in the mid-infrared of type 1A supernovae. And I'm like, God, this is great. Anyway, so some kind of asymmetry. We don't know exactly what it is. We interpret it as possibly a ring or a prolate shape with a hole down the middle. I don't think we know the geometry. But we see it in both those argon lines. It's unambiguously asymmetric in some way. Okay, so here's my conclusions. First few points are a very broad outlook since we're all here taking shots at one another and trying to summarize where things stand. So I would say, so the top part is broad and the bottom part here, sort of what I've tried to say in the talk. So one point is, it is true, you have to match the peak brightness of a supernova if you're trying to understand it. You've got to get the light curve right. That's necessary, but it's not sufficient. The state of the art is more sophisticated than that. You really have to understand the spectral evolution at some level. So to earn a seat at the table, to talk about things that are some reasonable representation of the observations, your dynamic model has to do at least as good a job of matching the spectral evolution as a spherical delayed detonation model. And they're not the end of the story, but they do a pretty good job of both the normal ones and the subluminous ones and the spectral evolution as well as the light curves for normally bright ones and subluminous ones. It's a pretty high bar, and other models have to at least match that. Now, it's also true that we have to understand that transition. So we saw a lot of very interesting talks about that this morning. I think we're making some progress towards understanding that transition to detonations. It is also true that the spherical delayed detonation models aren't complete, and we're seeing signs of the asymmetries in the polarization, getting some nice models coming out that reproduce that. This layering, if we see it in the mid-infrared, is not consistent with the basic delayed detonation model. So this isn't an ultimate defense of them. They're saying that they make a pretty high standard of quantitative agreement with the observations that people have to reproduce. So in terms of what I said today, we don't see any carbon in the normally bright ones. We do see oxygen and magnesium out at the very high velocities. for these core normal ones, I think that rules out the deflagration models for that class of things. I think we do need to think observationally, how do we discriminate between a deflagration model and a delayed detonation model for these subluminous ones? Now, my personal opinion is, I think Dan Kasten got that right, and Powell basically said the same thing, that they have the same energy. And you can't do that with burning basically the whole thing. So I think, in my mind, that points at the delayed detonation models, but for the subluminous ones, maybe there's still an issue here that both the theorists and the observers ought to think about. And then finally, in this mid-infrared, we're just opening up that window, but I hope by showing you that one spectrum, convince you that there's really some wonderful things to learn in that part of the wavelength band. Thanks.
Thank you, Craig. Questions?
Go in the back.
Hey. Hello?
And no, I have no idea what a Super Chandrasekhar model will do in the mid-infrared.
That's not what I'm going to ask. So, okay, one thing is about carbon, right? It's not that you have a constraint on the whole supernova, it's that you have a constraint with phase, right?
So, like, constraint with?
With phase. Like, if you're observing it, let's say, a week after max or something like that, if the carbon's on the outside, it gets diluted really quickly.
Well, it is important to look early.
Sorry?
It's important to look early, so that's what we've done.
Right.
We've got pre-maximum spectrum, and you know there is no carbon on the outside, is what I'm saying.
So when we see what we think is carbon in an optical spectrum, right, it's almost always really early, like a week before maximum. And there are some examples of, like, a week before maximum, you know, what's probably carbon. Right?
Probably.
So
the stuff I'm showing you is definitely
all
carbon.
All right. Very good.
Or not. But, I mean, we can see it in the subluminous ones. We definitely see the carbon one lines. Whether you're seeing a carbon 2 line in the optical, in those spectra, I'm not sure. There's something that needs to be understood there. I'm not sure. I think the infrared is much more unambiguous.
So
when you see the carbon,
what would be really interesting is a plot of phase versus carbon constraint, because then
enough. I don't think we presented it in quite that way, but one could. Yeah.
And then the other thing is that with the argon double peak thing. That doesn't necessarily mean it's asymmetric, right? Because a disk or a shell could give you the same sort of double-horned profile, I think.
It depends on what you think I mean by asymmetric. I just mean not spherically symmetric.
Well, it could be spherically symmetric, but just in, a shell, right? Because, you know, like accretion disks, right? They're famous for giving this sort of same kind of profile, depending on how you tilt them.
Flat. No, I guess a thick shell with a hole in the middle would be.
Does it?
Flat.
Okay, I don't know. Well.
Craig, the features you're looking at in argon are seen all the time in nova spectra and are explained quite carefully in Payne Kapochkin's book in 1957, where they are, these rings.
I don't, if it's explaining them in novae and explaining them in this.
No, I'm talking about you.
I don't think the same thing.
It's the geometry of the ejecta.
A ring. No, I understand a ring will explain it, but it only shows up in the argon, not in the other lines. So it needs to be understood in that context. Yeah, exactly. So why is the argon in a different spatial distribution than the other things? That is the issue.
Craig, in your mid-infrared spectrum, if you had a hole in the nickel, I would expect, wouldn't you expect the cobalt lines to be flat-topped? And in that spectrum, they look pretty sharp to me.
They do look pretty sharp there, don't they? And so, it's a question of kind of the resolution. I don't know. That occurred to me as I was putting this together. But yeah. So, this is pretty unambiguous, and that is pretty sharp. This needs to be understood. But we need more. We also need more. I'm sorry, go ahead, Bob.
No.
You do have to make sure that, one of these is argon and this isn't something else. Yeah, we took a lot of encouragement from the fact that we saw that double peak profile at the same separation in two different argon lines. But if there's something, so we need more type 1As. We need to look at this with a larger sample. This was the first one out to shoot.
I just don't know how thorough the analysis is about what all the possibilities are and what the sort of maybe.
I accept that caveat. This is, we've just opened this window.
Keith first, then Alex. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I just wanted to expand a bit on what Bob is saying. What worries me a little bit is that you have one line there being argon 2 and the other one argon 3. If that's correct, then I'm not even sure those should be co-spatial. So,
point taken.
You know, so the coincidence in the line profiles may be just that, a coincidence.
We do have to be very sure that the identifications are proper.
Yeah.
I wouldn't write too many papers on the asymmetric argon yet.
Hi, Craig.
That's what I say in this talk.
So you raise a very good point about the low luminosity delayed detonation models and the presence of carbon in the low luminosity ones. But I'm a little surprised, I guess, that you're not so sure that some of the carbon signatures that we claim we see in the optical might be something else. I think that was the implication that I took from what you said a few moments ago to Andy. I think the identifications in at least two of those are pretty solid.
You're going to show them.
Yeah, I'm going to show the one tomorrow.
Fair enough. I don't know quite what to think about that. I know you guys have been working hard at that. And the question is whether those are, you know, always there. If they're there sometimes, what is that saying about those particular ones where that carbon 2 line is there? And I don't say that. I do know that, you know, in these normally bright things, the carbon lines aren't there. I mean, so if you have that carbon 2 optical feature in one where I flat do not see the carbon 1 lines in the infrared, then we have a real issue. I don't think we've got the same data set on, but that day will come. If we keep collecting data, we'll get.
Craig, just to discuss the iron a little bit more, some of us were talking after Ken's talk, and could it be that the flat-topped iron in the infrared spectra is coming from a deeper layer than the more sharply peaked iron lines that are seen in the optical spectra? Maybe the ejecta aren't completely optically thin, and the mid-infrared spectra are looking farther down in,
mm-hmm.
where you're seeing the evidence for the hole, and the optical people aren't seeing the evidence for the hole because they're looking at layers that are still farther out because the ejecta are still, to some degree, optically thick. They're not fully nebular.
I think that's certainly the
Well, Wolfgang says they're nebular, but I'm trying to probe just how nebular are they.
Yeah.
Are the infrared photons coming from, on average, deeper down in?
This particular spectrum is 135 days, but
yeah,
we have other type 1As
not particular
at later times, and we can ask that kind of question in the whole data set.
Yeah. Right. So that was the infrared spectrum. So I agree that one might be coming from very far in, but the optical spectrum might not be probing quite such a deep layer, and maybe that's why the lines aren't as flat top. Well, then we have a clear inconsistency, right? I'm trying to find a way to resolve that inconsistency. It ought to be. But then we have profile inconsistencies. So I'm just exploring how maybe. You know, they ought to be transparent, but maybe the ejecta aren't quite transparent. If they are transparent, then I go back to the missing hydrogen. Then there's no iron curtain. And then the missing hydrogen is a real problem for the single degenerates. Right? Because we're down to 0.01 solar masses or lower now.
Might have that implication.
Yeah, one more question for David.
Let's hear from the moment.
Stan likes to say that the flame never dies. And I like to say that in the optical, the permitted FE2 lines never die. That's an empirical statement. So I think that it's relevant to the exchange that we're having now, is that even at surprisingly late times, the underlying emission is not a thermal continuum, of course, it's emission lines. But I think that as it emerges, it gets worked over and smoothed out by the Fe2 permitted lines. And that could be the answer to your problem, which is kind of what Alex is trying to say.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Okay.